Welcome to the 39th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as the festive season approaches, remember that a cricket podcast is for life, not just for Christmas.
And what a jam-packed episode we have for you this week, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to be reviewing the year. We're going to be having a look at Michael Atherton's very interesting Glorious Summer and Discontents. Is it Discontents or Discontents?
Discontent.
Discontents.
I mean, I don't think anyone says Discontents.
And we are going to be debating... looking back at the year, what have you got excited about?
The funny thing is, I've got my highlight of the year, my
it's
real
been the
moment
West Indies,
of the year.
Let me guess.
Well, no. I could.
Yeah, you could
have
picked
the West Indies victory in the T20. Yeah. But I didn't really engage with the T20 trophy in a big way, not till really the end. Now, my highlight, funnily enough, was the day on which England lost their world number one ranking, which seems like quite an odd choice. But I'll take you back. It was the Oval. It was the final day of the series. And England looked beat. They started the day 11 for 2. Cook and Strauss both gone. An improbable chase ahead of them to save their ranking. And they didn't make it. But what a fight of it they made. You know, Johnny Bairstow made runs, Pryor made runs, everyone seemed to chip in, even Swan in, you know,
it was the kind of situation where ordinarily England would have just completely folded. Basically, though, in a sense, there was nothing to fight for.
And
England had already lost. They'd lost the series. They'd lost the ranking, and they basically lost that match. And even though they made all those runs on the last day, they still lost that match.
Well, I think what was extraordinary about it is it should have been a really sad day for English cricket. The world number one ranking that we'd fought so hard for was about to go. But England, without Peterson and with young Bairstow having to step in, made such a fight of it, and it was such a compelling day to the extent that we're actually. A victory almost seemed possible. That improbable victory seemed on. And it was great there, Test cricket. And it also reminded you that after a really tough series against the South Africans, this English team still had an awful lot of bottle left.
Well, to be honest, actually, I have taken quite a lot of delight in England's failings as well this year. Simply because after we beat India last summer and we became summer before last and we became number one, I mean, I started thinking, are we going to turn into an Australian team from the 1990s? Is this all going to get very, very boring? But actually, what's been really nice about this year is the kind of cyclical nature of it. So we started in the subcontinent against Pakistan, getting whitewashed 3-0. And actually, an occasional whitewash really spices things up a bit, because it's been really interesting, because you then go forward to the end of the year in this series against India, and so many of the questions that were being asked at the beginning of the India series were made so much more interesting because of the context in the Pakistan series at the beginning of the year. And so there's something quite nice about still having an England side, but you're never quite sure how they're going to play. You're never quite sure who's going to turn up. I suppose it started with the captain himself, who came out of horrific run to score, you know, hundreds of runs against the Australians a couple of years ago. And that kind of tendency seems to have carried on within the team.
I think the Pakistan series was just an extraordinary shock to a lot of England fans who sort of got comfortable and got used to this idea of winning. But I do understand what you mean in terms of the cyclical nature of the year, because suddenly England are on the verge, as we record, of a really historic victory on the subcontinent. So having started the year being like, we can't play spin, we can't play in the subcontinent, there's that triumph. I mean, in between, I think the South Africa series was a very chastening experience for a lot of England fans. I mean, I get your point that in the interest of the game as a whole, it's quite nice that number one has remained very contested. And frankly, South Africa's less than convincing win in Australia suggests that it's still very much up for grabs. But I think there was something quite tough about seeing England consistently outplayed. And I think that the disappointing thing about the South Africa series actually was that there was a sense England never quite did themselves justice.
Sloppy, has been ordinary, has been poor, some people would call it rubbish.
So what's what let you down?
Well, what let me down was far, far away from the international realm. And was the fact that the very kind of prosaic
Was it your poor average side?
No, you'd be surprised. I made plenty of runs this summer when I had the chance, because it was a miserable summer. It was a damp, wet, squib of a summer. And for me, I was trying to think, well, what has been my low point of the year? And I suddenly got this image of us in Hove, supposed to be watching the West Indies, watching Darren Sammy and his sodden companions waiting by the side. And that was the story of my cricketing summer. I mean, I tried to watch games on several occasions. I think I watched about 2 days of cricket this summer. Yeah. Repeated failures to watch games and repeated failures to play. And I think it was... It, rammed home, I think, what a fragile game this is. You know, you have a summer like that, and suddenly it all got very miserable.
It seems churlish, perhaps, to compare that kind of misery to the kind of misery that the Pakistani team have been going through, where they, I mean, we haven't been able to play because of rain, they haven't been able to play because of bombs. Essentially, you know, they can't play Test cricket at home. They started off the year playing in, you know, this sort of bright new dawn almost. They've got a country that's willing to host them, where they almost have a home crowd.
And conditions that seem to suit them
and
very well.
And conditions that suit them. They whitewashed England. And then since then, they've played one test series, where they lost to Sri Lanka away. And they only have one further test series in the diary against South Africa away in, I think, February. And it just seems to me that after that sort of new dawn at the beginning of the year, Pakistani cricket just does not seem to be going anywhere. No one seems to be sort of taking it by the scruff of the neck and giving it a sense of direction. And that seems to be one of the problems that has plagued it for years, and one of the problems that actually provides a breeding ground for the kind of corruption that's sprung up and the kind of lawlessness within the team, as it were, in the sense that just no one is willing to lead the whole process.
But it was a very talented Pakistani side that saw off England this year. And you thought, well, I mean, in its own way, that was an extraordinary comeback story. You know, you think back to Mohammad Amir and Asif and the humiliation of that whole series. I mean, what a comeback. But you're quite right, the schedule has just not given them the opportunity to build on that success.
From the archives, and in the wake of Freddie Flintoff's boxing debut last month, when, to a mixture of admiration and derision, he fought as a professional, and doing so joined a tiny elite who have competed in both sports, this episode, Andy is going to introduce us to the boxing cricketers.
Let's go back to 1882 and John Douglas. John Douglas captained England either side of the First World War. In 1911, he was rather successful when he led England to a 4-1 win in Australia. Post-World War I, however, he was considerably less successful, where he led England to a 5-0 whitewash, which was a margin of defeat that actually England weren't to suffer again in Australia until the infamous Flintoff-led side back in 2006.
Well, there's a connection already.
Exactly, quite. But probably my favourite thing about John Douglas is his rather wonderful nickname. His initials, JWHT, were imaginatively improved on by the Australians, who came up with the excellent nickname Johnny Won't Hit Today, because of his famously defiant and tedious batting style. Quite a useful bowler, apparently, as well. Now, as a boxer, he was able to actually balance his cricket and boxing career simultaneously, so he was building a very impressive reputation with Essex, while also becoming widely respected as the best middleweight in the country. The highlight of his career comes in the London Olympics, 1908, and with a performance described by the Times as one of the most brilliant exhibitions of skillful boxing allied to tremendous hitting ever seen. He secures 3 victories inside a single day and wins the gold medal. It's quite entertaining that the professional, amateur boxing at this stage doesn't seem to have been a particularly large tent, in that his father is also the head of the Amateur Boxing Association and presents him with the gold medal. So we wonder if there's any nepotism involved in that.
This might be sort of a question too far, but how good was boxing back then? In the sense of, is it just a case of someone who was, you know, he was a good enough cricketer and boxing was simply something that was basically an amateur sport in the kind of derogatory sense of amateur?
This is an absolutely crucial question, because we look back on these people who you were, you know, successful at internationals in multiple sports and think, God, weren't they unbelievable? And I'm sure they were very talented, but I think it is worth bearing in mind what being an international meant at that stage. It was vastly less professional than now, and simply the pool of people involved was so tiny. And that certainly seems to have been the case within sort of amateur boxing.
And I imagine actually that it was a slightly, boxing was, I mean, I know absolutely, as you know, absolutely nothing about boxing, but I'd imagine that it wasn't, say now, where it's based a lot on kind of strength and a lot on sort of physical condition. It probably, you know, Douglas probably didn't look like Lennox Lewis.
Well, it is funny you should say that, because actually Douglas was renowned as the fittest cricketer of his day, and he did. His boxing does seem to have given him quite an extraordinary physique, which had a kind of other interesting consequence, because up to that point, you know, I think very few people had taken the idea that having a good physique was important for cricket, and the fact that Douglas kind of ended up with one via boxing just seemed to help him out by accident. One thing to kind of note is that Douglas was a notoriously boring batsman. I mean, really painfully boring. And yet, as a boxer, he was entertaining, he was flashy, he was a showman. And it's kind of interesting that you know, your personality doesn't necessarily cross over from sport to sport. It doesn't necessarily follow in that respect. Let's leave Douglas behind and fast forward to, well, the middle of the 20th century, post-Second World War, and Bill Alley, the Australian Bill Alley. In 1948, Bradman told Alley he was going to be picked for Australia. But it turns out the Don was wrong. Alley would never represent Australia. Instead, he headed to England, became a dominant force in the Lancashire Leagues, before signing for Somerset at 38, which is, you know, pretty late to begin a county career. Nevertheless, built an incredibly successful career there, became something of a Taunton legend. 19,500 runs in 12 years, 738 wickets, you know, stats speak for themselves.
19,500 runs in 12 years.
I know.
I mean, that is a sign of
through your 40s, through your 40s as well.
And that's what, 1,300 a year or something.
But before any of this, before becoming a Taunton legend, which, yeah, seems like a real honour, he was an incredibly successful boxer in Australia, 28 bouts unbeaten as a welterweight, and made some good money through it as well, which I guess says a lot about the, you know, the potential motivation. In his, the way his boxing career came to an end is really interesting. In his own words, "I was given a 12-rounder and I sensed the betting boys were moving in. Although I was expected to win, I was ordered to lie down. I walked out of the fight and boxing in disgust." So what drove Alley away from boxing was its seedy side. Yeah. And I guess it's much harder to say now in the era where cricket is so tainted by match fixing and the like. But it's interesting that within cricket, he obviously found a sort of fairer game, perhaps. Unlike Douglas, whose approach to sort of boxing and cricket was so far apart, Alley seemed to take his fighting, combative approach into his cricket. This is a guy who squared up at one point to Fred Truman, batted with constant aggression, always keen to exchange choice words.
I wonder what effect it has playing against someone who you know is a prize fighter.
Mm. Well, he's an imposing. I mean, he was an imposing figure, Alley.
There's certainly, there's a Scottish rugby player called, is it Alistair? Someone, Strokosh, who's an amazing judo player. And apparently, I mean, you know, people actually sort of realise this, and it gives you a bit of sort of, makes you slightly tentative. And I just wonder whether, if you are squaring up against someone who you know the night before has been beating someone else black and blue, whether it has a slightly different dynamic.
Well, certainly, Ali seemed to enjoy that. Yeah. I mean, he seemed to carry that aggression with him into the sort of, onto the cricket pitch. Let's fast forward hugely now to Adam Holyoake. Led Surrey, never really made it with England, but led Surrey to 3 county championships, played 4 tests for England, did actually captain England to the fairly poorly regarded Sharjah Trophy in ODI, so, you know, there's a success.
When was that?
late 90s. But it was significant at the time because England simply didn't win anything in ODIs.
Well, it's like boxing where you have all those belts that are completely meaningless. Well,
quite, and this was the Sharjah Trophy was the cricket, packet. Yeah. Holyoake's, unlike Alley and Douglas, he obviously had to sacrifice his boxing interest very early on to cricket, but it was there from a young age. Age 12, he used to sneak out to go to boxing classes. Eventually, his parents put a stop to it, unpleased with the people he was spending time with, hanging out with. but it was after his cricket career finished that he dedicated himself properly to the sport. Actually built a very impressive record as an amateur before turning pro. He's so far got 1 victory, 1 defeat. Slightly more insanely, he's also made a foray into the even more brutal sport of mixed martial arts, which is kind of not just boxing, but there's taekwondo, there's all sorts of things.
I mean, when you say mixed martial arts, I thought it was sort of mixed gender rather than mixed discipline.
No, it's just sort of do what the hell you want, really.
Right.
As opposed to boxing, which has sort of some
cage
restrictions.
Fighting,
quite. It is basically cage fighting.
And that's the stuff that he's got the kind of publicity for, hasn't he?
Right.
Because that is... And it's quite... one of the reasons I've always thought that, you know, cricketers who go on to box get so much attention is because everything about cricket, from the, you know, the English green countryside to the white clothes, angelic clothes...
It's a long way from cage fighting.
It's a long, long way from the kind of... it's actually quite a shock seeing Flintoff in a boxing ring, just because the way that it presents someone and the image behind the whole thing is so completely different.
Well, I guess it links into that idea of, well, are there similar skills? Are there comparable skills? I mean, are there things you can take from cricket to boxing? Hollyoak's very clear on the fact he thinks they're entirely different. He actually suggests that in cricket, what you're constantly trying to do is psych yourself up to face every ball, to focus on every ball. He says in boxing, the real art is to calm yourself down, which is interesting. However, it does appear that the composure of Hollyoak's career has really helped him out. There's an extraordinary story of his first mixed martial arts fight, where in Hollyoak's words, Hollyoak describes the first round, it's never a good thing when you have a 90-kilo man on top of you trying to rain down punches in your face, which I think is a very, you know, apt description. Reports on this fight, they suggest Hollyoak was completely calm, completely composed, got up, dominated the second and third round. So perhaps that same composure from cricket was transferred to boxing. As a sort of final aside, Hollyoak has this rather bizarre line where he suggests every athlete has a mental disorder. And his argument is basically that the desire to pursue sport to the highest level is a mental disorder. He says it's an obsession that's only really justified when it comes off. And he says, well, obviously for the majority of people, it doesn't come off. And I do think it's quite an interesting point, because when people have asked, you know, why does Flintoff put himself through this after the success of the Riptide? You know, why does Hollyoak put himself into cage fighting? Maybe we are looking at something, a fundamental mental trait that leads sportsmen that, you know, cricket's not enough for them. They need to take themselves that bit further. To the book review, and this episode we're looking at Glorious Summers and Discontents by former England captain and now very successful Times columnist Mike Atherton.
It's an unusual form of book, and actually when I picked it up and first looked at it, I thought it was going to be pretty dry, pretty tedious. It is a collection of his columns for various... Are they just for the Times, or are they for various...
Primarily for the Times.
Primarily for the Times, but there are one or two from elsewhere.
And it feels lazy initially, doesn't it? You feel as a format...
Lazy, exactly, and you sort of... wonder kind of what new is going to be added, because these are all things that are written on the spur of the moment, and often what you want to get is an element of retrospection about things and people looking back over whole episodes. But one of the great benefits, I think, of the book is the fact that you don't have that retrospection, and what that brings is two things. Firstly, it shows you what a fine judgment Atherton has, that when he's writing things in the midst of the moment, he's then proven right later on. But he also, in some of the sections that take essays about specific episodes recently, you get a real sense of very vivid narrative. So, for instance, there's a very good section about when Kevin Peterson was briefly made England captain, and one essay ends with, he's been made England captain, it might work, but it's a huge gamble, and if it doesn't pay off, England are going to pay. And then the next article begins, England made a gamble, it hasn't paid off. And that sense of being right in it and not knowing. Atherton doesn't know what's going to happen next, you almost didn't know.
And Atherton's quite, he's quite proud of himself. In his introduction, he does say, I'm pleasantly surprised reading through many of these pieces again how my judgment has been more accurate than flawed. And to give him credit, what else can you judge a pundit by? I mean, that's what we ask our pundits, to give us insight. And again, he kind of calls it right. And he does talk about this thing that, you know, we do expect a certain sense of intuition on behalf of our really valuable columnists. We don't want them just to state the facts. We want them to kind of offer an opinion, offer a sense. I think there's something particularly odd about, because the pieces all are from sort of 2000, 2010. It's that decade that's covered. And I think what's quite curious is reading a book about... We read so many books about cricket from the distant past, and reading a period that we've lived through, seen as history and analysed as history, is quite curious.
Yeah, and one of the nice things about having Atherton as our guide is that he is someone whose judgment is so... Because, I mean, we live in an age where... And he spends quite a lot of time deriding Twitter... But we live in an age where there is judgment just flying around all over the place.
Well, opinions are and seen opinions. As almost valuable in themselves.
Exactly. And actually, you feel really secure with Atherton that when he's making assumptions... There's a section that's about the 2010-11 Ashes in Australia. And at the beginning, in three pages, Atherton, and this is looking back, this isn't an essay, this is a little introduction to the section, looking back, he just lays out why England won. and they're huge sweeping judgments, and there are massive assumptions that underlie a lot of it. But you're reading it, and you do just think, yes, this is someone who knows what they're talking about. And that's a really, really valuable thing when thinking about
I guess it connects with an argument we've had before on this podcast, which is the fact that he's both a very intelligent man and an ex-England captain does give... He gives his judgment a lot of weight. You give him a lot of respect. I also thought... You know, the word polemic has very kind of negative connotations in our culture. It's kind of like a rant. But Atherton's often polemical. Mm. And I actually think there's a lot to be defended in it. Particularly his anti-Alan Stanford rants are so justified in hindsight. And they're made very coherently. But I think, if anything, his kind of most vicious bile is kind of kept for the ICC. And he's angry about it, but it's an anger based on someone who loves the game deeply. And his criticisms are kind of valid and strong. And you read this and you increasingly just feel... If something does need to change, well, there's no point hinting or suggesting. You know, we do need people to be bold. We do need people to aggressively call for change.
And yet he's not a one-dimensional writer as well. He has a huge number of different tones of voices that he employs very effectively. So towards the beginning of the book, there are sections about, as you say, about Alan Stanford, among others, which are pretty vicious, actually. But then there's also a collection of essays towards the end that are about individual cricketers, one of them which is about Mackay and Tini, and it's on the day that Mackay and Tini reached his 100th test, and it's a really, really touching testimony to him. And it sort of has this amazing ability to sort of be able to survey things on a sort of macro level. And he talks about the way that Mackay and Tini was a flagship for South African black cricket, but also the tiny little personal details that he brings in. And there's a real warmth to his writing in it.
Well, I think that's what is fascinating about this book, is it kind of shows how diverse Atherton's job has had to be. Because, you know, the structure pretty much sticks to the title, Glorious Summers and Discontents. The first half of the book is really about the miserable difficulties the game found itself in, match fixing, the ICC's general failures, Stanford. And then all of a sudden, halfway through, it becomes a real triumph, a real description of the glories of the game. And it's interesting that Atherton's kind of had to do both sides. He's had to investigate the darkness of the game, but still had the appetite to praise everything that's good about it.
For the debate, in this episode, we're going to be asking whether England fans should be optimistic about 2013.
It's easy to forget after having just won a very significant victory in the subcontinent, but 2012 for England was really about hosting South Africa. That was the big series. And we lost that series, and we lost it pretty conclusively. We rarely were able to compete on a sort of matched level with the South Africans, and I think that does have to leave you slightly concerned going to 2013, which, let's remember, is a year of two Ashes series where we're going to face that higher level of competition. I think the India series is something to be very positive about, but it's also worth remembering there were some very special circumstances there. India looked a tired, out-of-sorts side, desperately in need of, frankly, new blood, and England also, and it's maybe the only time we'll really ever say this about an England side, did benefit hugely from having two spinners that were able to exploit the conditions far better. If anything, England have found their seam attack, James Anderson aside, looking slightly jaded after this Indies. I mean, Stuart Broad's confidence in particular has taken quite a major hit going into 2013.
I think your point about the South Africa series is entirely right, and there were some big questions there. But I don't think they should write off the England side, and I don't think they should write off the England side for two big reasons, one of which is the India series, which, yes, there are questions over some of the batsmen still, but I think people like Joe Root coming into the batting lineup and doing really well was a very positive thing. Obviously, Alastair Cook has shown that he is, you know, top-notch, and Kevin Peterson has been reintegrated into the side. But I think the biggest thing that's come out of 2012 and that's going to sort of look forward into the future is that the post Strauss era has really been defined quite definitively. It has been defined definitively. And Alastair Cook has shown himself to be a really good captain. He's shown that it hasn't affected batting, although time will tell on that front. And what's also, I think, very good is the pragmatism of going for the split coach approach with Andy Flower. And this I mean, so today, for instance, it was announced that Kevin Peterson won't be going to any of the one-dayers in New Zealand. And that kind of mindset that England have always toyed with, the idea that they should be able to manage their players and manage their workload, seems to be coming really to the front. And I think that's going to be really important as they play, what, 57,000 matches against New Zealand, home and away, about a similar number.
I mean, there's a couple of interesting points there. I mean, the split coaching thing is a really interesting idea, yet to see how it will work. I mean, frankly, it's got to the stage in one-day cricket where you feel like England could try anything, it's worth trying anything, and maybe the arrival of Ashley Giles there will improve things, having someone focused on it. You also raised there an excellent point that I think we only realised, looking ahead to England's schedule for next year. It's extraordinary how many times England fans are going to have to watch England play New Zealand. And frankly, that in itself seems a cause for some minor pessimism. It also, if we're being frank, it doesn't necessarily seem like the best preparation for what is surely going to be two very tough Ashes series against an Australia side that, even though they were beaten by South Africa, it must be admitted they competed far better with the South Africans than England did. As a seam attack, Australia are bringing a kind of challenge to England that England certainly didn't have to face, obviously, in India.
I take your point absolutely about the perils of having to watch New Zealand for too long. But then again, there is always the fact that as a fan, England do manage to always screw up in some way in a series against New Zealand, which if nothing else provides a bit of comedy value.
Well, okay, so we can at least look forward to some comedy. I think the other issue here is that we've actually got a side that Alistair Cook has been brilliant, but how often did the England batting lineup end up relying on Cook, relying on Peterson? And I think there's still a sense that I share your excitement about Joe Root, but you have to. There's still a sense that the batting lineup as a whole is not firing collectively as often as perhaps it used to at that time when England were really sort of on top of the game, and that you do feel every time Cook goes cheaply, you shudder because you feel like our kind of key insulation blanket has gone.
Yeah, but I think, you know, Ian Bell had a really difficult series but scored a century in the final game. I think everyone sort of contributed at some point. Trott made runs at other points. And absolutely, I think there's something... There's always a natural cycle with batting lineups, which is that you're always going to have two or three people who are making lots of runs while another two or three are quiet. And it's the case when Ian Bell was scoring hundreds of runs and Cook was scoring hardly any at the same time. But I think there's something about the natural rhythm of things that we shouldn't get too worried about with the England batting lineup.
I think, I mean, one area where I am optimistic about next year, and I sort of say this with slightly crossed fingers, is that it does seem like the whole Kevin Peterson debacle has been put to bed. You made the point that today it's been announced that he won't be, his commitments seem to be being managed a bit more intelligently, and it'd be great for him if he's not in the news. Well, not in the news for the wrong reasons, at least. Do you feel the Stuart Broad's difficult time in India is something that we should be worried about, or can we write that off as a blip?
To be honest, I don't know if England really going to miss him, to be brutal. I think that having not had him in the side and still won on the subcontinent, it's been, you know, he had huge promise when he first came into the side, but he's not been scoring any runs and his bowling hasn't been as penetrative as it once was. And I think, frankly, it's no bad thing if he's injured in England, they miss him.
Thanks again for listening to Reverse Rot Radio. Have a great Christmas and a happy new year, and we will see you in 2013.